Welcome to the Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie. On this week's The Space Show, a progress report on the Artemis 1 mission to the Moon and the trials and tribulations of the tiny fellow travellers. But first up, we have Space Show News. The Artemis Accords are agreements between 21 countries designed to facilitate a shared vision for civil space exploration, science, and commercial activities for all humanity. Australia is a signatory to these accords. As part of Australia's contribution, the Australian Research Council has announced funding for a new Adelaide-based research centre for Excellence in Plants for Space. The aim is to develop nutritious food, on-demand supply of materials and medicines for the next generation of space explorers. The project will be led by the University of Adelaide in partnership with Australian and overseas organisations and institutions. One of these is Flinders University. The centre will be funded to the tune of $90 million, including $600,000 from the South Australian State Government. The funding will commence next year. The research centre will create new plant efficiency solutions for challenging Earth environments. It will also develop intensive, sustainable production plant-based foods with potential to reduce agriculture's carbon footprint. The director of the new centre has been named as Professor Matthew Gillingham of the University of Adelaide. He said the Plants for Space Centre will create the flexible, plant-based solutions needed to support human physical and psychological well-being during deep space travel and settlement. He also said the mission is to reimagine plant design and bioresource production. This would enable off-Earth habitation and provide transformative solutions to improve on-Earth sustainability. The centre's deputy director is Professor Melissa Desart of Flinders University. She said that they would train 400 researchers and produce the next generation of industry-focused experts. The University of Melbourne is one of the institutions involved in the Plants for Space project. Another is La Trobe University.
Let's take a trip to the moon. Come on, let's go for the moon. Let's take a trip to the moon.
Yes, the rest of this evening's The Space Show is devoted to the Artemis 1 mission, which has gone around the back of the moon. Yes, the Orion spaceship has flown behind the moon. And we have this report from Mission Control in Houston on the close flyby of the moon.
We're now 5 days, 6 hours, and 27 minutes into the historic flight of Artemis 1. The Orion spacecraft just recently emerged from the backside of the moon after completing the outbound-powered flyby. Coming up at MET, 5 days, 6 hours, and 52 minutes, which is about 54 minutes after the OPF burnout, Orion is slated to fly extremely close to the Apollo 11 landing site. The Apollo 11 landing site, named Tranquility Base, was where Commander Neil Armstrong and Lunar Module pilot Buzz Aldrin touched down on July 20th, 1969, 53 years ago. During the flyover, Orion will be 1,384 statute miles above the landing site. As Orion continues to swing around the moon toward entry into distant retrograde orbit, we were just getting some views of the Earth from about 220,000 miles away. 33 minutes ago, Orion completed the outbound-powered flyby burn, which lasted 2 minutes and 30 seconds, which sent Orion close enough to the lunar surface to leverage the moon's gravitational force and swing the spacecraft around the moon toward entry into distant retrograde orbit. Next up for Orion will be insertion into distant retrograde orbit, where it will remain for one-half long elliptical orbit around the moon. Following this, Orion will complete a similar maneuver in which it flies behind the moon in a return power flyby. And as you might expect, just the opposite of the outbound powered flyby. This maneuver will help put Orion on a trajectory to return back to Earth and splash down in the Pacific Ocean on December 11th.
So Orion passed within 130 kilometers of the lunar surface. The speed was increased by the orbital maneuvering system engine from 3,400 kilometers per hour to 8,323 kilometers per hour. And it was mentioned there it was going to go into a distant retrograde orbit. Well, that will happen on Friday. And what, you ask, is a distant retrograde orbit? Well, we heard this explanation.
The outbound-powered flyby will send Orion close enough to the lunar surface to leverage the moon's gravitational force and swing the spacecraft once around the moon toward entry into what we call a distant retrograde orbit. Following this, Orion will remain in the distant retrograde orbit for one long elliptical orbit around the moon, lasting about 6 days. Now, this orbit is called distant due to the high altitude from the moon. It's about 40,000 miles past the moon in its orbit, which is actually 30,000 miles farther than the previous record set during Apollo 13. And this will be the farthest in space any spacecraft built for humans will have ever flown. This orbit is also called retrograde because Orion will be traveling around the moon opposite the direction the moon travels around the Earth. This DRO provides a highly stable orbit where little fuel is required to stay for an extended trip in deep space in order to put Orion's systems through its paces and to the tests in an environment far from Earth ahead of crewed flights.
Also, you heard mention of the orbital maneuvering system engine. Again, we heard this explanation.
If you're just joining us, we're bringing you live coverage of today's upcoming outbound-powered flyby burn, which will slingshot us around the backside of the moon. Today's burn will take place with the Orbital Maneuvering System, or OMS, engine. This engine has been used several times throughout Orion's five-day journey to the moon. This is that large engine located on the bottom of the service module, and the engine can provide 6,000 pounds of thrust. Today's burn will last 2 minutes and 30 seconds, but the burn can be used for burns lasting up to 16 minutes in length. The OMS engine onboard Orion is a repurposed Space Shuttle Orbital Maneuvering System engine that has flown in space before. It flew on 19 Space Shuttle flights, beginning with STS-41G in October of 1984 and ending with STS-112 in October of 2002. Now, the OMS engine is not the only engine on board the Orion spacecraft. There are also 8 auxiliary engines. These are located on the bottom of the service module as well, but in 4 sets of 2. These are used to provide trajectory corrections and as a backup to the main engine, and each engine provides about 100 pounds of thrust. In total, there are 33 engines aboard Orion.
So, on the basis that a very distant relationship is a relationship of sorts, that orbital maneuvering system engine on Orion has a connection to Australia. You say, how come? Well, the first flight of that engine was on STS-41G, the Space Shuttle Challenger, in 1984, October. And guess who was aboard that flight? Paul Scully Power, the first Australian ever to go into space. He spent 8 days and 5.5 hours and did 132 orbits of the Earth. And he was very glad that that OMS engine fired successfully to slow the shuttle down and bring him back down to Earth. Also glad for the same reason was pilot Pam Malroy on STS-112. That was in 2002 October on the Space Shuttle Atlantis. Well, Pam Malroy is now Deputy Administrator and previously was a frequent visitor to Australia as a consultant for one of our space companies. So there you have it, some connection to Australia. Now, Launch Director Charlie Blackwell Thompson spoke to her crew in the firing room at the Kennedy Space Center immediately after the launch of the first Space Launch System rocket last Wednesday. She was the first female director for the launch control.
So you guys know I have talked a lot about appreciating the moment that you're in. And we have worked hard as a team. You guys have worked hard as a team for this moment. This is your moment. It is not by chance that you are here today. So I want you to look around at this team, and know that you have earned it. You have earned your place in the room. You've earned this moment. You have earned your place in history. You were part of a first. Doesn't come along very often. Once in a career, maybe. But we are all part of something incredibly special, the first launch of Artemis. The first step in returning our country to the moon and on to Mars. What you have done will, what you have done today will inspire generations to come. So thank you. Thank you for your resilience. You know, I said at the pre-test briefing, the harder the climb, the better the view. We showed the Space Coast tonight. What a beautiful view it is. So congratulations.
Many of you will have a piece of technology on your mobile telephone and perhaps even a computer called Alexa. Some of you may have used it. Well, there is Alexa aboard the Orion spacecraft. This is an explanation of how Alexa works.
So one of the strong reasons we, after chatting with Amazon, we then reached out to Cisco, who's the premier leader in connectivity, I would say, because we realized we wanted to have an exercise of the system without the crew on board that would connect us to what we call virtual crew members back in the Mission Control Center. In what is called the Ops Suite 5 that we'll be using throughout the mission. So the concept is from Mission Control, testers, you could call them virtual crew members in a way, will ask a question of Alexa via the WebEx system. We'll be able to then observe, because of the cameras and speakers and microphones we have on board, we'll observe that did come out through the speakers in the spacecraft. Alexa will process that audio in the spacecraft in that acoustic environment, which I can tell you I learned more about acoustics than I thought I ever would. It is not designed for acoustics, right? It's a small metal enclosure. So we had to work through all of that. She'll interpret that voice control and actually by being connected to the telemetry stream in Orion, provide information and data synthesis from the actual spacecraft. So they're not pre-recorded messages. It's not canned things. It's actual real-time processing of the onboard computer data through the telemetry interfaces, and then she'll respond. The key is that all of that smart has to be on the spacecraft, because we didn't want to suffer the time lag of going back up to the spacecraft, back down to Earth, back up and back down again, for the Alexa device to connect out to the internet. So her voice processing, everything that happens in the cloud here on Earth, is actually embedded on a dedicated spacecraft computer in the spacecraft. So we'll interact with her via the WebEx connectivity, video conference, and she'll respond in real time with real data from the spacecraft to test out the technology end-to-end.
And why was Alexa chosen?
For both of our partners, we looked at what the technologies that were out there, but also at the kind of common mission statements we saw with the companies. And I'll be honest, we picked up the phone and called Amazon, and it was one of those, hey, what do you think about flying an Alexa on the other side of the moon? And I expected to get a very puzzled response, but instead they explained that one of the, and this is their story, but they share it a lot, one of the progenitors for Alexa, one of the thoughts that they had, if you will, was the voice computer from Starship Enterprise. And so in some ways they said, we've kind of been waiting for this moment in some ways. So as soon as we started talking with them and talked about some of their local here on Earth activities where they have to operate Alexa without the internet, we realized it was a really awesome test case for what they wanted to do. So the response was so strong, and the technologies and the knowledge was so deep, and our kind of commitment to the mission and connectivity was really powerful off the get-go, that we just never looked back.
Aboard the spacecraft are two phantom females. Why were they there?
Why are they called phantoms, and how did Helga and Zohar get their name?
I will answer the scientific question first. The phantoms we are using, or Helga and Zohar, they are in principle based on phantoms which are used on Earth for radiation treatment planning in hospitals. So if you work on cancer treatment plans in hospitals, you use phantoms, which are so-called anthropomorphic phantoms, which reassemble, in principle, a human body. So both for Helga and Zohar, they are made out of different materials, out of epoxy resin, which different substitutes to really reassemble like human bones, human lung tissue, human brain tissue. So in principle, the phantoms are tissue equivalent. If you have radiation passing through the phantoms, the interaction of these radiations are similar to the interaction of radiation passing through a human body. That's why they are called anthropomorphic phantoms. Actually based or come from cancer therapy applications. And since we are talking about space radiation, and you know, in cancer therapy, you also use protons or carbon ions to treat cancer. And the radiation field in space also has these proton ions and these carbon ions. It's a little bit more complicated. But in principle, we just translate these medical phantoms into space. Concerning the names, well, as far as I know, for Zohar, since Zohar is the Israel phantom, there was a naming ideas to find out the name for Zohar, and at the end Zohar came up, and I think Zohar is an Hebrew name, and it means actually, I think, in English, radiance, so that's actually quite fine. And Helga was the same. I mean, Helga is a very typical, let's call it a German name for the phantoms.
Southern FM.
The sounds of the Bayside.
A few months ago, when they were preparing the Artemis 1 mission for launch, they had a few problems with the space launch system, and it was delayed. But anyway, at that time, a bunch of people at NASA and some European Space Agency people and also some of the contractors got together, and well, they had a bit of fun with the old song Fly Me to the Moon. So, and this was released just a few days ago. So enjoy Fly Me to the Moon by the employees of NASA and the European Space Agency and the contractors.
Let me see what spring is like on
a Jupiter and Mars.
In other words,
hold my hand.
In other words,
baby, kiss me.
Fill my heart with song
and let me sing. Evermore.
You are all I long for,
all I worship and adore.
In other words,
please be true.
In other words,
I had a good time performing that. Now, Jeff Radigan is the flight director for Artemis 1 at the Johnson Space Center. 3 days out into the mission, he gave this report.
Well, I got to tell you, it's a great day to be in the control center anytime we're flying a spacecraft to the moon. It's just a lot of fun for all of us that are operating the vehicle and checking it out, putting it through its paces. Today, the team was out doing the survey of the external of the crew module and the service module using the Orion cameras to take a look at every inch of the vehicle that we can see, really check out and see how the exterior surface of the vehicle is doing. Of course, the team's preparing for the outbound flyby and, you know, the OPF maneuver that's coming up. We've got a couple of trajectory corrections before we get there. That we'll do over the next couple of days. And then, of course, we'll do the burn 70 nautical miles off the backside of the moon for about 2.5 minutes, and the burn will really put us on our way to the distant retrograde orbit, which is where we're going to continue the checkout of Orion. All of us will really be looking to receive data since the burn is done on the backside of the moon, and we'll lose comm with the vehicle for a little bit of time. It'll autonomously do the burn, and then we'll pick data up and see how Orion's doing. That'll lead us to actually 4 days later, where we'll do the DRI burn, the distant retrograde insertion, which is what really is the final step of putting us into lunar orbit. And that'll be another minute and a half burn that Orion will do and drop us off into the orbit where we'll continue to check out Orion. So you probably hear it in my voice. It's very exciting just for us in Mission Control. It's been a very exciting mission. There's been a couple of anomalies we've had to work, but overall a very clean mission, and we're really, really having a good time.
Jim Jeffrey is the integration manager for the Orion vehicle.
Wednesday was quite a stunning event for the entire team. It was a fantastic performance by the rocket to deliver Orion to space. And it's been a really exciting few days for both the team and the spacecraft as we learn how this system operates in the deep space environment. It's a good reminder that this is the first time in 50 years that a human exploration spacecraft has left low Earth orbit and been sent to the moon. Orion's been performing great so far. All the systems are exceeding expectations from a performance standpoint, and we have full mission functionality with the upcoming outbound powered flyby burn. The team's been able to gather a lot of great data to learn how those systems are performing in space. You know, no ground test is a perfect representation of flying in the real environment. And so we've been able to collect this data, use it to update our models, understand how the system is trending, and make decisions for our upcoming mission events. As Jeff said, we have the big burn coming up on early Monday morning, the separation of Orion from the interim cryopropulsion stage. Once the ICPS finished its job and sent us on through the TLI, Orion fired its pyrotechnic frangible nuts and separated from the ICPS. The solar arrays have been articulating during the deployment event. There's four different solar arrays on board Orion. Each are about 4 meters long. And one of the things we've already learned from the mission is that we're collecting more power than we expected. Altogether, we have over 13 kilowatts of power that can power the equipment on board. The deployment went great. Other systems have also been performing fantastically. We've had better than expected heat rejection. We're using less power than anticipated. So all these things are giving us good confidence in being able to move forward with the mission and also expand our capabilities as we go forward.
Mike Sarafin is the mission manager for Artemis 1, and he gave his update.
Well, good afternoon, and thank you for continuing to follow the Artemis program and the Artemis 1 mission. In terms of flight test objectives, as we talked prior to the mission, we have four primary objectives. Priority one is demonstrate the vehicle at lunar reentry conditions. Priority two is to demonstrate the vehicle in the flight environment. Priority three is to retrieve the vehicle. And priority four is what we call bonus objectives associated with science, technology demonstrations, and outreach to each and every one of you. We have completed the first half of Priority 1 with the Space Launch System delivering Orion to the point of translunar injection and putting all of the kinetic and potential energy into the spacecraft, and now we need to take that out, and we will realize the second half of that objective on entry and splashdown day. Priority 2 and Priority 4, we are 20% complete with the objectives. 26 of 124 objectives are already complete. We have 40% of the remaining objectives, or 50 of the 124, in progress, and then we have about 40% or 48 of the 124 remaining ahead of us. But overall, the mission in just 3 short days is proceeding and exceeding expectations. In terms of payloads, we did successfully deploy all 10 of the 10 CubeSats. We are getting reports from a number of the payload customers that show that half of them are successfully executing their mission, and the other half are working through a series of issues with either intermittent communications or just some of the CubeSats themselves are having difficulties. One of those is a success story that we were concerned about prior to flight, which was the Luna HMAP CubeSat that we were concerned had a low battery state of charge. That one actually is on path to have a successful mission. The payloads on board Orion, 3 of the 4 that we have, we don't get any real-time telemetry data from the bio experiment number 1. All that data is recorded on board and recovered post-flight. The ESA active dosimeter experiment, again, is recorded on board and recovered post-flight, as well as the Matryoshka Askarad experiment, or MARI experiment, that is recorded on board and recovered post-flight. But the Callisto technology demonstration payload has checked out. We've checked it out through the Deep Space Network. We've had a Snoopy sighting in the cockpit.
Let's take a trip to the moon. Come on, let's go for the moon. Let's take a trip to the moon.
In Qatar, some folks are trying their best to propel small spherical leather objects into a rectangular net. Elsewhere on Earth, other folks are trying to direct small cuboidal objects into or around a very distant and large spherical object. That object is, of course, the moon, and the cuboidal objects are a cluster of 10 CubeSats launched with Artemis 1. Just what are CubeSats, I hear you ask?
Hey everybody, technology is always getting smaller. A computer used to take up an entire room, but now it fits in the palm of your hand. Well, spacecraft aren't all that different. They're traditionally very large and difficult to build, but we're working on ways to miniaturize them. We're going to talk all about that on this episode of Crazy Engineering. Hey everybody, we're here with Andy Klesch in one of JPL's smaller clean rooms. We're building CubeSats in here. Andy, what exactly is a CubeSat?
A CubeSat is really just a standard for a small spacecraft, and we're talking a very small spacecraft, 10 by 10 by 10 centimeters at the smallest on here. And yet they go up to about 30 by 20 by 10 centimeters. And we've launched hundreds into low Earth orbit for the last 10, 15 years.
So this really is in a big contrast to how we normally operate at JPL with our larger clean rooms and our larger spacecraft.
It is. We're trying things a little bit different over here. It's much more rapid development, trying things out with 3D printing and building things up a lot quicker because these missions are a lot smaller.
If I were to build Voyager today, could I miniaturize it? Could I make it really small?
Absolutely not. Voyager has so many different capabilities, and these CubeSats are very, very limited, but they're very focused on what they do, so they can do one thing and do it very, very well.
You're the chief engineer of one of these CubeSat projects. Could you tell us a little bit about the one you're working on?
I work on Marco, or Mars Cube 1.
Can we take a look at the spacecraft?
Absolutely. It's right here.
This looks more like a computer to me than a spacecraft. Can you explain a little bit about how it works?
We have a propulsion system to actually steer us to Mars, a radio to talk back to Earth, and the computer and electronics so that we can actually operate.
So Marco's actually going to Mars?
That's right. We're launching with InSight.
So Marco will travel along with InSight all the way to Mars?
Actually, there are two identical Marco spacecraft, and they'll separate from InSight at Earth. Each spacecraft will then travel to Mars on its own over 6.5 months. Marco's single purpose is to relay data back from InSight during its entry, descent, and landing at Mars. We're really excited about this. It's the first interplanetary CubeSats that we'll have.
What do you see for the future of CubeSats?
Because these are low cost, we see them going to many cool places throughout the solar system. We also see them working together, what we call fractionated space, where the spacecraft is really broken up into all individual instruments, each with a focused task. And together, they're performing the entire mission.
We're hoping to see all kinds of new technology with CubeSats down the road. Andy, thank you so much for showing this to us. Hope you guys had a lot of fun learning about it. Check back soon for some more crazy engineering.
The Omotenashi project was very ambitious. It intended to land the smallest ever spacecraft on the moon. Now, by small, think 700 grams. Yes, 700 grams. After a valiant struggle to overcome numerous problems, the mission team had to give up and have their lander make an uncontrolled flyby of the moon and onto heliocentric orbit. After separation from the Space Launch System rocket, the radio signal from Omotenashi was unstable, making it challenging to get telemetry from NASA's Deep Space Network station in Madrid. When the CubeSat was finally found and the signal locked onto, the project team in Japan discovered the solar cells were facing away from the sun. Worse still, Omotenashi was rotating fast. The team decided to use the propulsion system to stop its spin rather than attempt to use the attitude control system to direct the solar cells at the sun. After that, they switched operations from stopping the spin to changing the spin axis to obtain solar direction. This decision was made because the battery voltage was dropping. However, the battery power was depleted and the radio transmission stopped when Madrid stopped tracking it. The Omotenashi team thought that no components on the spacecraft were broken. On Thursday, the team expressed a determination to press on and recover the craft's attitude and power and to complete the mission. They asked for amateur radio hams to listen in for the satellite on 137.31 megahertz and for the surface probe after landing, on 437.41 megahertz. Meanwhile, the project team was considering driving the reaction wheel in manual mode to change the attitude. On November the 21st, the team reported that, regrettably, radio waves from the spacecraft were not being received. They were assuming that the orbit of the spacecraft was almost the same as when it separated from the rocket. Just in case, they considered the possibility that the orbit was off, and they moved the direction of the tracking antenna to widen the search angle. They had planned to use the 64-meter diameter antenna at the USADA station in Japan, but decided to use the 34-meter antenna in Yoshinoura because it has a wider antenna beam width. Late on Monday, the project team realized that the originally planned landing method could not be carried out. They hoped that if it recovered by the end of the day, Omotenashi would still be able to slow down with its solid rocket and free fall to the lunar surface when passing its perilunar point, that is, the closest point to the moon. The team worked feverishly late into the evening to develop and confirm the procedure for establishing three-axis attitude control, preparation for the landing, and transmitting the landing sequence. To that end, they prepared a command file. They conducted an operational rehearsal using the spacecraft simulator to see if there were any problems with this procedure. They also booked time with NASA's Deep Space Network. Early yesterday, the project team said that, unfortunately, they were unable to receive a signal from Omotenashi. The lunar landing experiment could not be carried out. The craft passed the moon and is continuing on a curved path into heliocentric orbit. On November the 27th, it will depart the Earth's gravitational sphere of influence. Although the team has given up spacecraft operations for now, they think the solar cells will be illuminated in March next year. They say that they would like to resume exploration operations at that time and to carry out test items that can be done in orbit. And we have more of the sad news about the CubeSats after these messages.
You're listening to 88.3 Southern FM, the sounds of the Bayside.
Where this is the space show. Equalus is one of two Japanese CubeSats launched on the Artemis 1 mission. EQUULEUS is an acronym for Equilibrium Lunar Earth 0.6U spacecraft. It carries two scientific instruments and is designed to be placed at the second Lagrange point of the Earth-Moon system. This is a point directly 50,000 kilometres behind the Moon. Because Equalus will not sit exactly at L2, but will instead orbit it, the craft will be able to communicate with Earth. Now, this is important to the operation of the two instruments. One is called Delphinus, which is an acronym for Detection Camera for Lunar Impact Phenomena in 6U Spacecraft. Delphinus is a camera to observe the flashes made by meteorites and asteroids hitting the far side of the Moon. Now, if the names Equalus and Delphinus sound familiar, it is because they are two of the 88 recognized constellations of stars. The Equalus spacecraft was proposed by the University of Tokyo and the Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency. After the initial flyby of the moon this week, Equalis plans to demonstrate low-energy trajectory control techniques. In addition to looking for flashes of light from lunar impacts, the Delfinus camera will observe near-Earth objects such as asteroids, comets, and many moons temporarily captured into orbit around the Earth. The second scientific experiment on Equalis is a small ultraviolet telescope named Phoenix. No, Phoenix is not the mythical immortal bird. This is an acronym for Plasmaspheric Helium Ion Observation by Enhanced New Imager in Extreme Ultraviolet. Helium ions emit light with a wavelength of 30.4 nanometers. Such ions surround the Earth in what is called the plasmasphere. It is held in place by the Earth's magnetic field. By being 500,000 kilometers from Earth, Phoenix will provide the whole image of the Earth's plasmasphere and be able to observe how it changes. The L2 point in the Earth-Moon system will likely be important for future spaceflight. It could be the site of a future spaceport for deep space exploration. A spacecraft can arrive and depart from L2 with little amount of orbital control. Departing spacecraft can transfer to various orbits such as Earth orbits, moon orbits, and interplanetary trajectories. Now, Equalis separated normally from the SLS rocket and on November the 16th was confirmed to be operating normally. 3 days later, the Equalis team reported that they had completed the eighth communication pass with the spacecraft. Orbit determination, establishment of triaxial attitude control, and normal operation of the water propulsion system were confirmed. Yes, water propulsion. Plans were being made to correct the course for the moon flyby. Now, since water propulsion had never been done before, the team had to master the technique in just a few days. Had the water propulsion not worked, Equalis would have swung around the moon, swept past the Earth, and out into interplanetary space to endlessly orbit the sun. On November the 20th, Equalis was 370,000 kilometres from Earth and on course for lunar flyby and thence onto that L2 Lagrange point. On November the 21st, the operations team reported that they had successfully achieved the orbital control required to enter an orbit using the gravity of the Moon and the Sun. Now, this is called a low energy transfer. The path after the lunar flyby is barycentric, one that orbits both the Earth and the Moon. The closest approach to the Moon by Equalis was 5,000 kilometres at 1:25 a.m. Japan time on November the 22nd. That was 3:25 a.m. Australian Eastern Daylight Time. Later that day, Equalis was contacted confirming a successful lunar flyby. The trajectory was being monitored to see if corrections were required. So it looks like all going well with the second of these Japanese spacecraft. Well, another satellite that was launched on a Artemis 1 mission was Luna HMAP. And Craig Hardgrove is Assistant Professor at the School of Earth and Space Exploration at Arizona State University. And he had this to say about the concept.
I'm Craig Hardgrove, and I'm leading a team of researchers that's sending this spacecraft to the moon. This isn't a scaled-down version. This is the actual size of our spacecraft. It's called the Lunar Polar Hydrogen Mapper, or LUNAMAP for short. LUNAMAP will launch on one of the most powerful rockets ever built by NASA. And this tiny spacecraft will propel itself into lunar orbit using its own propulsion system. And that's a first for a spacecraft this small. As with any first, it's also very risky. I want to tell you about this mission, why we're going to the moon, and why it's worth the risk. We're sending LunaMap to the moon to sniff out just how much hydrogen is beneath the surface. And we're looking for hydrogen because it's a key component of water. Water is geologically interesting on the moon. How did it get there? It's also important for future human exploration, since it could be used as fuel. The moon could be a jumping-off point for the rest of the solar system. But the moon is a harsh place. It barely has any atmosphere at all. The temperature can change by more than 100 degrees from day to night. And in that type of environment, any ice or water that's hit by sunlight would immediately be lost to space. But there's a lot of scientific evidence that suggests water ice could be present on the moon within special, eternally dark crater floors at the South Pole. These regions are in permanent shadow. They're some of the coldest places in the entire solar system. So that's where LunaMap is headed. LunaMap will carry a tiny science instrument called a neutron detector, which is sensitive to the low-energy neutrons that are leaking out of the top meter of the moon's surface. We can use that total number of neutrons to determine how much hydrogen is trapped below. And that, too, is something that's never before been attempted on a spacecraft this small. But in order to improve upon the previous measurements of ice at the moon's south pole, LunaMap needs to get very close. Really, really close. It turns out we need to be about 30,000 feet above the surface of the moon, which is the typical cruising altitude for a commercial airplane. But we need to make our measurements while orbiting over the moon at about 4,000 miles per hour. And that's 8 times faster than your typical commercial airplane. All of this, you guessed it, is a first for a spacecraft this small. So you might reasonably wonder where an audacious idea like a shoebox-sized spacecraft capable of doing all these things came from. About 10 years ago, a university professor wanted to come up with class projects for his engineering students. The idea was to have them build small, functional benchtop components that might be used on a spacecraft, but with the added engineering challenge of making them fit into a very tiny box. These were just student learning tools and demonstrations. So when thinking about the dimensions of his tiny box, he decided on a Beanie Baby box, 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters. He called them CubeSats. Surely, he thought, something this small would never fly into space and never actually do anything useful. But as a student training exercise, they were perfect. The idea of CubeSats was a success. Universities across the country adopted CubeSats, and they became a successful teaching tool and development platform. Perhaps a little too successful, because piece by piece, over the last 10 years, the components that make up LunaMap have been developed at or in partnership with universities, their faculty, their students, and staff. So over the years, if students were lucky enough, their CubeSats would be launched into low Earth orbit to test their designs in space. And they wound up not just testing designs, but developing new miniaturized spacecraft technologies. Eventually, university students developed radios, instruments, reaction wheels, propulsion systems, and many other components, until someone asked a really good question. Don't all these components put together make up an interplanetary spacecraft? And they do, as long as we accept the inherent risk of using any new technology. Take a different industry from our own lives, for example, smartphones. No one gives up on smartphones entirely if there are bugs in the first version. New technology always improves over time, but the first version is a little risky. And there's a funny thing that happens when you start accepting risk, and accepting a lot of it. With a risky spacecraft, you can do risky things. Things you wouldn't normally do on a typical big NASA mission that takes decades to design, build, and fly. Think about it. Would you risk your spacecraft after a decade of work? It's not likely. But with shorter development times, smaller teams, lower costs, it actually allows you to embrace risk and hopefully reap the rewards. In fact, I'd argue that this is fundamental to what makes tiny missions like these worth doing. You may remember probe droids from Star Wars, expendable robots deployed to capture unique, hard-to-get data about, say, a rebel base. Imagine if we had a dozen or more tiny probes on every NASA mission. They could fly low over the icy surface of Europa, transmit valuable data from the atmosphere of Venus on descent just before being crushed by the intense atmospheric pressure. These probes can act as interplanetary scouts, deploying from a primary spacecraft, maneuvering to intersect with asteroids that no spacecraft has ever before visited. And these are just a few examples of the type of risky but highly rewarding missions that these tiny probes might take on as we venture out further into the solar system. Now, risk is a part of all of our lives, and it can be scary. But very few rewards come without risk. Personally, I chose to pursue this mission as a postdoc at ASU. It's uncommon to give a moon mission to someone who is essentially fresh out of their PhD. But despite the risks, I put everything I had into it. I devoted many months of pulling together our team and working on the proposal. And our team, despite the risks, put everything they had into it, too. I'll be honest, we all knew the chances of success were low, and the risk of failing was high, but the rewards were even higher, and that's what kept and keeps us going. It should sound familiar. High risk, high reward. The concept of these tiny spacecraft is something that we all truly believe in. It represents a vision of a future world that we want to live in, where space is more accessible than ever, and to many more people than ever before. And that makes the risk of working on LunaMap worth it. I wouldn't have done anything else. And the best part is I get to lead this visionary team of people and work with colleagues every day who believe in it too.
Well, Craig Hargrave, high risk. Well, we'll find about that in a moment. After deployment from the SLS rocket, Luna HMAP was to use its low-thrust iodine ion propulsion system to position itself into a highly elliptical orbit with perihelion over the South Pole. And it will take up to 70 days for the spacecraft to be weakly captured by the moon's gravity. Then another year would be required to achieve an elliptical operational orbit. The target orbit has an aphelion of 3,150 kilometres and perihelion of 8 kilometres. The objective is to have 2 months of science collection. Well, on November 17, the Lunar HMAP team reported that their spacecraft had called home, some 5.5 hours after liftoff, and that its batteries were charging. The team were receiving signals and had successfully sent a command and received confirmation. Yesterday, the spacecraft was healthy and all systems were go for last night's lunar flyby. The solar arrays had been successfully commissioned, and the radio neutron spectrometer and various spacecraft bus systems had been checked out. The neutron spectrometer collected a set of cruise data that indicated the detector is functioning normally. However, all has not gone well for Luna HMAP. The day after the launch, the mission team powered on the propulsion system. After many ignition attempts, the system was not able to achieve thrust prior to yesterday morning's lunar flyby. This propulsive maneuver was required as a step towards putting the craft into its planned polar orbit around the moon. Based on the propulsion data, the team has assessed that the propulsion system valve may be partially stuck. They say heating this valve over many hours may result in freeing it, allowing for ignition. Therefore, the spacecraft was instructed to heat the propulsion valve. Now, if the propulsion system is able to achieve thrust within the next few months, the mission may still recover some of the Lunar HMAP's original science mission. If more than a few months is required to heat the valve and ignite the propulsion system, then trajectory solutions may exist outside the Earth-Moon system. Then these could allow the craft to fly close to certain asteroids and characterize their hydrogen content. So, not good news for some of those CubeSats launched on the Artemis 1 mission. Well, this has been the Space Show. I'm Andrew Rennie, and hopefully we'll have more news about those CubeSats in next week's The Space Show.